Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown, and I'm Lynn Kerrigan, host of this week's Brown Briefly. You know, since Brian's been gone from us for a year now, we recently met remotely to discuss the turn of events this past year and how its intensity has affected us all and the show. We thought we'd review the original intent of the Briefly, which is not only billed as progressive persuasion, but also humorous observations and conversation about current events. We decided we wanted a return to the lighthearted conversational tone of earlier shows and have decided to emphasize the local nature of our program rather than compete with MSNBC or CNN to try to analyze and make sense of national political news. We want to bring this show home. Brilliant and scintillating though we are, we're going to attempt to turn back time to a kinder, gentler variety program ranging from the galactic to local community concerns and see if we can do that without Brian's guiding star. If we can do it, maybe Biden can. With me in our remote island locations through the magic of Zoom is the intrepid Brown Briefly team minus Michael Shook. I wanted to mention that Michael's last show was on Groundhog's Day after about 5 years of Briefly commentary to return to a life of planting and fertilizing on his peaceful property. I hope he's finally seeing the sun through all these March clouds. Let's start with introductions, announcements, and everyone's most interesting Vachon happenings. First, Truman O'Brien, master of the airwaves in the beautiful downtown Jean Bosch studio. Truman engineers our entries and exits, our voice volumes, clips, and sound effects. Got one for us, Truman?
I'm working on it. Let's see if it's going to come here. Here we go. Ooh, here we go. There it is. All right, of course, from Jaws. You get put a little mystery into the show this morning.
Mud sharks or dogfish?
Yeah, probably both. We want to keep
Wait
it local,
minute.
Right?
That's don't tease everybody. That's the Vachon hum. We all know it.
Right? That's right. That's right.
We
right.
Do.
That's right. That's right. You know, of course,
Truman,
is
Vachon coming out of its long hibernation? What's going on around town that wakes you up?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, I've been working the vaccination site, and folks are so thrilled and excited to be getting their vaccinations, and of course now we're doing the folks from the school. So we have teachers and folks who work at the school that are beginning to get there. So we're getting some younger folks coming through, but everyone is just so pleased. And one woman said, "Oh, I just feel this great weight coming off my shoulders," and it's kind of what everybody has felt. And of course, with the weather starting to change a little bit and the days getting a bit longer, it's just a real positive attitude that's suddenly taken over the island. It's very very gratifying.
Isn't that great? And we're doing really well getting a great majority of our older people vaccinated now, and all the healthcare workers. And so, as you mentioned, I wanted to say that the appointment openings started yesterday for more shots. And that I think that as we move on to adding teachers and the essential workers that you mentioned in the grocery stores and, you know, people carrying the heavy loads and not able to Zoom are going to be protected also. I'm really happy about it. Thanks for mentioning that, Truman. Next, historian Bruce Holman is our famous guardian of the galaxy, documenting our place in history. Bruce, what are you involved now in now?
Well, lots of things as always, but interestingly enough, 1 year ago today, was the issuing of the very first SITREP, or Situation Report, that came out from the Vashon EOC and Vashon Be Prepared. And so it's been a year. And on the 11th, 2 days from now, was when the Vashon Emergency Operations Center was mobilized in response to the pandemic. And on March 11th was the very first COVID case on Vashon. So it's been a year that we've been in this process. And Truman, you'll appreciate this. As of this week, 97% of Vashon Islanders over age 65 have been vaccinated at least one shot.
97%.
So, 97%. It's been an incredible process.
I cannot doubt that at all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and
go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, just, you know, a big shout out to all the folks with Vashon Be Prepared, the Medical Reserve Corps, CERT, NERO, I mean, all the folks that have been in the Emergency Operations Center to really make Vashon. Vashon has the lowest infection rate of any community in Washington State. So we're in a very, very favorable position. In terms of the museum, there's a couple things going on this weekend. This week, Thursday evening, there's a talk about the In and Out exhibit by the two curators, Ellen Kritzman and Stephen Silla. And it's sort of a celebration of that exhibit, which will be up for another couple months. We're sort of determining when the museum will be opening, but probably a phase kind of opening of our next exhibit that will occur, start with the outside part in June and July, and then open the inside of the museum in September, if everything goes as planned and the variants don't go wild and if there's not another huge strike and lots of caveats. But essentially, we've lived with a year of caveats, you know, so we're used to it. But it's a very exciting time on Vashon.
Bruce, how do people access the Thursday evening talk that Stephen and Ellen are going to do about this exhibit?
Sure. You know? They can go to the museum website, and there's a link on there. It's a webinar, so you just sign up for it, and then you'll be sent the login information for it. It's free, but they're going to sort of review the whole process of putting it together. They've got some great sort of interviews with LGBTQ community on Vashon, a great sort of 10-minute sort of review of the exhibit that was done by a group of filmmakers from Los Angeles. So it's going to be a really interesting program.
Thank you. It's a fabulous exhibit. I cried through a lot of it. It's so profound to see our local neighbors coming out personally, loud and proud, and in this context of the struggles legally that have happened over time and the demonstrations and all of the losses to AIDS patients, it was really moving. It's kind of living history at its best, in my opinion, of, you know, bringing current events back into that history and then back again outside for some reflection at the Memorial Garden and at a gender quadrant where you can actually put your flag where you think you lie between being of a certain sexual orientation, gender orientation. It's fascinating. Thank you.
And may I throw out, please, that it is the VashonHeritageMuseum.org. That's the full website.
Thank you.
So let's be sure you get the right URL for
Vashon
that.
Vashon Heritage.
VashonHeritageMuseum.org. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Truman.
Great. Thank you, Truman.
Next. Poet, teacher, and author Gail Kellner brings a unique futuristic perspective to the Brieflies. Gail, have you attended any of Vashon's arts or literary offerings online? Is it a beautiful day in your neighborhood? And as a teacher, what do you think about kids learning remotely versus returning to school? Throw a bunch of stuff at you.
See what sticks. Yeah. Like spaghetti on the ceiling. Yeah, you know, it's been really, we're just beginning into the spring low tides on the island, and out walking a couple days ago, I saw for the first time, a starfish, commonly known as a starfish, they're technically a sea star, on the beach. And they had their own little pandemic, so to speak, that we lost not all, but many, many starfish during that time. So it was really wonderful to see a healthy starfish out on my walk. And I'm wondering if others have begun to notice them as well. And I also, you know, in the last couple of years, being a beachcomber that I am, I really noticed the sand dollars. And of course, they harken back to the time when dollars were round and coins. So they look like an old-fashioned dollar coin. And I'm seeing in the last year or two a return of those in large numbers. So that's unusual and different. Haven't seen that in my. We'd find them occasionally. I've been wandering these beaches and go on 60 years now, and so it's interesting to see. It's interesting to watch and see those changes. And the other happy news, I guess, to report on the beachfront is the a significant return in the seagrass. That is something that the efforts that people have made to and I'm not, you know, it has to do with the way boats are anchored, the pollution levels in the sound, all kinds of things affect that. But I am seeing larger and larger patches of seagrass as I'm out walking. So that's my happy news on that. And I was really glad to see that Governor Inslee included teachers in the current vaccination schedule. I really think it's wonderful that's been done and kids are being able to begin to make their way back into school. Thanks for asking.
Great. Thank you, Gail. And next, Kevin Jones, our activist warrior who brings a can-do attitude to community life here. How's your local work with Indivisible Vashon been faring since the election, Kevin? And what's your focus now? And you also have a new radio program and podcast. How is all that working out for you?
Well, you know, it always keeps me busier than I imagined that I ever could be. But you know, there are silver linings there. Both, you know, Indivisible Vashon and Vashon Climate Action Group is sort of a time of reflection. Now that we, of course, have turned the year page on the year, we turn the page on the administration. The radio show tonight, the Progressive Vashon podcast, is going to actually talk about that. Now that COVID relief is potentially going to be, you know, passed to the president's desk after the vote tomorrow, what are these progressive policies that are next? And so Indivisible founders Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin are going to be talking with podcast host Stephen Cox recorded earlier about what's next for the progressive movement. So that's a great place to catch up with what we're doing. The one other thing, you know, you talked about what's going on the island. And I'll tell you something that caught my eye. If you haven't had a chance to meet Hillary Emmer, it's a treat yet in your future. I haven't had a chance to talk multiple times with Hillary at Thriftway back in the days when we actually could talk at Thriftway. And I always learn more than I thought I could ever learn from talking to one person. Hillary is arranging King County has a special enrollment for health insurance for those who may have been displaced from the workforce or even had your hours reduced to the point where your income may be at a point where you now qualify for this health care. And on Wednesday, March 17th, out in front of the library from noon to 3, there will be some folks there from King County. Miguel Urquiza, I'm not sure if I have his last name pronounced right, will be there. Miguel speaks Spanish. He speaks English. He's creative. He can help you navigate the system if you're looking to say, hey, maybe I don't have health care. Maybe I could benefit from the service. So again, awesome support to our neighborhood from Hillary. I just want to give her a shout out.
Oh, great. And I just wanted to, I want to thank you for bringing up that new open sign up for the Affordable Care Act. I understand it will be open to new enrollees through May 15th, I believe it is, which is unusual. Mm-hmm. You know, usually that's November, December enrollment period, but it kind of got left in the dust over this last election and even for the last 4 years. So I was really pleased and really glad that you've got somebody coming in who's Spanish speaking and is going to be able to help make that accessible to everyone. Thanks so much, Kevin. And I'm Lynn Kerrigan. Excuse me. I'm a social worker and writer and musician, and y'all have covered a lot of what I was thinking about saying, so I'm going to throw in something that oddly struck me, and I'm not quite sure why. I think it had to do with the age of this albatross that made the newspapers last week. A 70-year-old albatross has hatched its 35th or 36th chick and has doubled the life expectancy of any previously known albatross. And I guess what sort of struck me about that is, you know, these birds fly from South America to Midway Island, way in the middle of the Pacific, to hatch. And I'm just, you know, at my 70s myself, and there's a bird that's still cranking out the babies. It just struck a chord in me that was somewhere between horror and admiration.
That's a great response to that.
I like to look into the natural world, and I appreciated your sea star stuff. You know, I kind of follow things like big iguanas and little iguanas that they found that are, you know, the size of your fingertip, and the male is smaller than the female and has to do athletics to be able to mate. I'm just really amazed at the natural world. It keeps me sane. So let's move on. I'm going to go back to the galactic news. Bruce, this one's for you, since you're the guardian of the galaxy. A Mars rover has landed this week looking for signs of life on that planet. I kept thinking, we can't manage life here. What do we plan to do if we find something there? Are we going to plant a flag and claim that planet for the U.S.? Are we going to grow that bacteria in the lab? And at the same time, Elon Musk launched SpaceX rocket last week, and it rose a few hundred feet and then fell crashing back to Earth. I was really kind of sorry for that and just think, well, that's sort of like the Tesla, you know, the first one kind of fell apart and now they're coming out with new models. And Bruce, I want to know where the Space Force is.
Well, I don't know. 60 Minutes this weekend had a great interview with the head of the NASA rocket program. Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember the name now. It's the new moon landing program that's named after the twin sister of Apollo. Anybody remember?
I saw that too, and I'm just trying to get it.
But they're planning on the first woman to land, the first astronaut to land on the moon is going to be a woman. So it's going to be very interesting. And the whole program is named after a Greek goddess rather than a Greek god, which is a significant shift. And as she talked, I mean, it's really fascinating to me. I mean, I really support what Musk is doing with the rocket program. You got to remember his other rocket has been, it's become like a Chevrolet. It's so dependable, and it's just sort of, you know, it's the workhorse of getting to the space station and back. The one that crashed is sort of a new model, and so there's going to be some development problems. But essentially, I think that's the way to go. Rockets that take off, land themselves, are reusable. The problem with the NASA program is every rocket is a one-time use, and then it's done. It's unsustainable. Whereas Musk, despite who he is and his issues that he brings, has the key to developing a space force that will get us up there and back in a way that's affordable and sustainable. Yeah, Truman.
Yeah, Artemis is the Artemis. Yeah, is Artemis. The
there you go. Partner. Thank you.
But you know, the other thing that strikes me, we've talked about this before, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on this, but you know, once again, here is here's that good old capital. Private industry versus government, and you know, what's more efficient, and And in this particular case, it really appears that the private enterprise is the one that's really going to take off, no pun intended, take off on this. And the government program is so heavy and weighted down with all of the development cost and all of those things that it's not as efficient by any means as the commercial one is.
Yeah, well, I guess, Kevin. If we're going to have oligarchs, they can put some of that fabulous money to use.
There you go.
Kevin.
No, I just was listening to something about economic investment in a nation, and they hearken back to Kennedy's statement, "We're going to the moon," and the mobilization that occurred when that happened, the mobilization of students into science and technology and math, engineering, the mobilization of money into technology. We don't have just Tang to enjoy because of the space program. There's phenomenal advantages in technology that have come from that. We're seeing some of those things now in our cars, where they are able to help us avoid accidents. Some of the navigation features of the space program have given us GPS, so we can get around without getting lost. And the thing that is always true, I believe, is that industry receives tremendous advantage from national investment. And today we're talking about possibly a hydrogen fuel, which is zero carbon and could actually potentially replace the kerosene, essentially, that we burn in engines when we fly airplanes. So the boost of national capital investment to allow industry to succeed, I believe, is really fundamental and not to be lost sight of. I'm certain that Mr. Musk would not have the resources to get to where he was today with actually a track record that's about as reliable as NASA, about 10% failure. Despite the recent news, he's about on par. It is cheaper, but of course he stands on a mountain of technology and intellectual property that's now been made available to folks like him.
Hey, Velcro, for crying out loud. Velcro is the space station
seat. From the space program?
Yeah.
Space blankets.
There you go.
Yeah. I want to know about how we can become space cadets.
I think we are. Not going there.
Already are.
Speak for yourself, Bruce. Gail.
I'm trying to think of an upbeat way to say this, but a piece of me has a great deal of caution when we advance on another planet. Our human beings in general, as they've moved into new places, such as, you know, from the old world to what we call the new world, has been disastrous for most every environment that we've entered. And I think that I think there's growing awareness about that, but I think that we should proceed with caution when we go into these new worlds. What is there that we might destroy before we ever realize it's there? What life forms might be threatened by our very landing and existence, let alone probing and attempts or talks of attempts to move and live there. So I would love to see, and perhaps this already exists and I don't know it. I know that there's a Treaty of the Moon, which, you know, it was organized to protect the use of the moon. It can't be used as a dumping grounds for any kind of pollution or waste. It cannot be militarized. And I would like to see something like that put together if it's not already, and perhaps it is.
Two things, you know, the Antarctic Treaty. I mean, the moon program was based on, I think, on the Antarctic Treaty for nothing, no development and all of that. Captain Joe just walked in. He'll be doing his show in a bit. And, of course, he can tell us a lot more about that particular treaty. But the other thing is, I think they go to great lengths to make sure that anything that we send to a different planet has been as sanitized as much as possible and de-microbed or whatever. Kevin?
Certainly, the traveling there from Earth is another way to probably, you know, take the life out of some of those things that might be attendant to those spaceships that we send. Yeah, I'm always just intrigued by this notion of Mars and life on Mars, and let's send a group out there to live on Mars as a alternative, right, to a threatened planet Earth. But you know, Mars is a very not hospitable environment, and the idea that to establish a civilization on Mars with the domes and the cities or underground where you have to create oxygen and water and so on and so on. You know, you can do that on Earth without having to ship it all to Mars. So exactly. It's just always really intriguing to me the sort of the romance versus the reality of a human outpost on Mars.
Thank you for that, Kevin. I couldn't agree more. And I think it is the cautionary note, and I'm not sure why I'm in this mode today, because I really like to be upbeat. But a cautionary note is that sometimes that idea that life can continue on Mars, so it's somehow okay to not take care of the Earth, or if once we've trashed the Earth completely, so it's fairly uninhabitable for ourselves and many other creatures, we can just go somewhere else. So I think that that's a cautionary note of caution that I put out there, that, you know, we have this one planet Earth. Most of us are never going anywhere else. And I think that we need to take care of this planet first, as well as use extreme caution as we advance in our exploration of other places.
There is no planet B, as they say.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think that is all fascinating, emerging news, but I'm going to start bringing us back from the galactic to some international news. And one of the things that I'm going to do is combine a couple of topics. I've been thinking about hacking, and I've been thinking about the stimulus checks that have been passed by Joe Biden, or the stimulus bill that finally made it through the Senate and the House. I think it's done or almost done. But a friend sent me this morning a Washington Post article that alerts us, in the midst of all this increased hacking through the Microsoft portal, there's also apparently a bunch of scammers now targeting the stimulus checks. And the Washington Post said, if you get any kind of communication that suggests that you have to apply for this money, the $1,400 or whatever it is that's coming to your family, and suggests that you have to kind of go through some middleman to get that application through, that is a scam. It's an emerging scam happening. And, you know, I just don't even know what to think about all of the hacks that are happening everywhere in our kind of quest between data privacy and data security. So, you know, I'm just wondering if any of y'all have kind of concerns, ideas, you know, what are you doing to protect yourself? Because it feels like big tech is selling our data like wild and has all these back doors for people to get in and manipulate all kinds of things.
The one thing that bothers me about all of this hacking is that I've gotten to the point where I don't even answer my phone, my landline, you know, and there's so much garbage out there that I got a call the other day saying, oh yeah, your account's been hacked and blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh yeah. Then guess what? My debit card didn't work. And indeed I had been hacked,
oh, no.
You know? And so, I mean, it was not a big deal. They canceled all the charges and reinstated my card and blah, blah, blah. But doggone it, you know, the real thing comes along and we ignore it because of all the, you know, garbage that's out there. So anyway.
Does anybody know anything more about, you know, since all of these hacks have been discovered recently, and I'll refer you to a kind of a great but very scary article that Jill Lepore wrote called Zero Day. And what that means is we have 0 days to fix something once a big hack happens. You know, it's so immense that you have to get on it immediately. And there's about 10 giant hacks that have happened in the last 10 years or so that, you know, have disrupted all manner of government agencies and communications. And you know, has become kind of a way of life now that we have the luxury of having digital communications everywhere. You know, does anybody know more than I do about what might be happening by the government to kind of try to protect our data?
Well, I think the, you know, the Biden administration is probably going to be more aware of those issues. I don't recall the details of what I've heard about the investment in cyber protection, but you know, it's a well known that it's been definitely an issue that has been expanding. It's an affordable, low risk to human life way to disrupt another country's operations.
Right.
The SolarWinds hack, which is the gigantic, you know, 80% of U.S. Businesses somehow, large businesses got hacked. I think the jury's definitely out on what consequences of that. My understanding of what I've read, which has not been a lot, is that the infiltration of the computing systems is through a software application which allows the network to be discovered. So in other words, I'm working on my laptop and I can discover, oh, there's three other people that I can connect my laptop to theirs, right, and work together. And so there's this map, right, of connected computing systems. And that, I believe, is the application that was hacked. I think what that means is that you can find which organizations are working with each other. It doesn't mean that you know what kind of data they're exchanging. So I don't know if anybody is advanced beyond that knowledge. That's the first reading that I saw. So is it a threat to us individually at this point? It's hard to say. Those other hacks where they discover your personal information certainly can be. But this one is not clear yet.
Well, here's both a scary and a heartening thing I just heard, and that is that the FBI now has all of the communications that occurred January 6th in Washington, D.C., from the cell data. They know who was talking with whom, and, you know, those calls that went to the White House, they know who they went to, from whom. I mean, it, on one hand, it's kind of scary that's out there. On the other hand, boy, they're going to nail some folks, I think, on this on the January 6th deal.
Well, it's interesting to me.
And that data collection is not done on a regular basis,
no.
Right? That has to be authorized by the courts in response to a specific threat. But yes, the capabilities in this country are amazing in terms of data collection. The regulations keep that data from being collected on normal, regular citizens who don't break the law.
I saw that there's a new option that is being suggested that's going to be called opt-in, I think, because right now I think the companies go ahead and take our data and what we can do is privacy, you know, settings on our own computer. But apparently somebody is introducing the idea that we need to be opting in to having our data sold and to having, you know, breaches be known to us, that we shouldn't just be kind of passive victims of this kind of manipulation, because for, you know, we are the people providing this apparently very valuable resource of all of our information. And it just seems to me like big tech has a job to do to make us a little safer in doing that work. And I personally, when I started, you know, doing Facebook or any kind of, you know, broader communications other than email, I had no idea that they're selling all this information on me. You know, I don't know what they think they're going to do with my information in my pitiful bank account, but I don't like it. And I would rather opt in than just be, you know, a victim to, I don't know, I've been hacked personally at least 5 times.
So I have to tell you, just this is kind of off the topic, but I just got a text message from a very, very good friend of mine in Valencia, Spain, and he sent me a note saying that he was listening to our show this morning, our morning scramble show, and I find that absolutely fascinating.
Valencia, Spain.
Yeah. And so I had to say good morning to him, and he wrote back and said, wow, it's really exciting hearing my name on the radio. You know, so anyway, I just thought I would throw that out. This technology thing is amazing. I mean, the fact that we're doing this Zoom meeting here is just blows my mind. So anyway,
amazing. It is amazing.
I will say, Lynn, regarding the opt-in, opt-out and the tech, there's two bills currently in the legislature. We just actually had Drew Hansen, Representative Drew Hansen, on our Invisible Monthly meeting last night, talking about his good bill, House Bill 1336. And he is very concerned about this issue. He pointed out in the meeting last night that the people who showed up to testify for House Bill 1336 involved, ACLU, people privacy concerns, et cetera. People who showed up to testify for the bad bill, Senate Bill 5062, were basically industry lobbyists and tech firm folks. So he said, that's all you need to know about which bill we want. Unfortunately, 5062 passed the Senate with quite large margins, and it's sponsored by Senator Wellman of Mercer Island. But there's some concerns that progressives are raising about that. So if you want to get involved, House Bill 1336 is the place you should look, and call your legislator and let them know you support that legislation if you care about this issue.
Thank you, Kevin. That's really valuable. I really appreciate it. You know, there's a bit of national news that kind of hit the papers this morning after I'd already sort of developed a bit of a draft script, but I want to mention it on the national news scale was the voting rights legislation or case that is going to come up to the Supreme Court about what the states are proposing to either make voting easier or make voting harder. And what I read this morning concerned me a little bit because it talked about the Supreme Court doesn't really want to weigh in on political issues. They say that it will make it look like they're partisan no matter how they rule. And what was odd to me about that was it seems like should they not be accountable to the Constitution rather than either political party? What do you think about that?
One of the difficulties there is the constitutional is open to interpretation in voting. Clearly, it gives all the powers to the states to determine who can vote and how they vote and all that sort of stuff. But there's also in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments and in the 21st Amendment elements that sort of give the federal authorities some power over determining voting, and so there's a conflict with it in the Constitution, and essentially the court is trying to avoid having to rule on that until there's clear legislation, and because the Voting Rights Act has basically been repealed, that's why House Resolution 1 is so important, a new Voting Rights Act that makes it very clear where the Congress stands and the executive, once it's signed into law, then becomes a basis on which I think the court will be much more comfortable making a move.
When you said specific legislation, they want to see that. Are you talking about this House Resolution 1, whether it yes. passes the House and Senate or not, right. and then it might be taken to the Supreme Court by one party yeah. or another?
It will be, yeah, that's what it is. Some states will take it because it prevents gerrymandering, which has always been a state purview. I mean, there's a number of sort of constitutional issues I see in that legislation that will come to the court, and I think the court will fall back on the 14th Amendment sort of element of it, a bit, sort of the one person, one vote concept. And then that will establish a new set of precedents moving into the future. I mean, that's really what I'm hoping happens. But you can understand why the court is reluctant to move at this point when this is still pending legislation.
It was more a philosophical discussion in that editorial, I think. Gail.
Oh, I wanted to ask the group, maybe Kevin in particular, can you talk about HR1, where it stands right now, those of us that would like to support it, how we might do that, and what's standing in the way?
Yeah, that's a really good question about HR1. So HR1 is generally the For the People Act, and it addresses a number of different aspects of voting access. I'm not sure that I have my summary handy. The biggest issue regarding HR1 today, it has passed the House. It's now S1 in the Senate, and it's unlikely to get any action in the Senate as long as we have a filibuster, which requires 60 votes to pass. And so we can talk a lot about S1 and what it does, but the important, since the filibuster is a prerequisite, we need to talk about the filibuster. We had a chance to actually meet with Senator Murray and talk about this issue of working across the aisle. And she is dedicated to that, as I think many senators are. She's also dedicated to making progress. And so the dichotomy has to eventually be solved. And she mentioned literally three times, I went back to the transcript, that, you know, if we can't find a way to work together, we will find a way to work to get the job that needs to be done, done. We created an action to contact Senator Murray to ask her how long she was going to give cooperation a try before she moved on to other ways to get things done. And so I would think the best thing we can do right now is, maybe illogical as it sounds, for S1, H1, HR1, is to contact Senator Murray, contact Senator Cantwell, ask them at what point they decide that they need to move forward without support from the other side of the aisle, and to remove the filibuster so that that legislation can actually get a vote and possibility of passage in the Senate.
Thank you, Kevin. Gail, you had
I just wanted to say, I had read in the New York Times this morning that there has been some movement around the filibuster, returning it to its older style, which was literally someone who had an objection to a bill had to stand up and continue, you know, talk and stand on the floor. So retaining that to perhaps slow down a vote or to give it a second thought, but certainly not to the point where we basically have the minority standing in the way of the majority rule. And in the case of, unfortunately, on many issues, Republicans would prefer to have no action at all. So they're quite happy, you know, to stand in the way, especially of something like this Voting Rights Act, or like the Voting Rights Act, this HR1 and S, is it called S1 now? Is that what it is?
In the Senate, it's S1. And oh, by the way, HR4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, will be introduced, I believe, this week. The COVID relief bill gets voted on tomorrow in the House, by the way, just because we have that mentioned earlier. And D.C. statehood for Washington, D.C. will be HR51 and S51. All of those bills are really important to support our democracy.
Absolutely, because I think, you know, just because I think that Democrats are going to be continually put in the position of being the underdog without some protection for the vote.
I'd like, if we can, maybe next week, I'm really curious about the filibuster. I know what it looks like right now, but what happens when it's, you know, we have a Republican in the White House and a Republican-controlled House and Senate? How's that going to, you know, sway? I really would like us to talk about that, but we are out of time today.
Who's on next week, Gail? Gail, we'll take
okay.
up that topic then.
So we have to sign off, folks. So
adios,
we will see
everybody.
You next-